Thank you, Barry. I don't want to do a Marco Rubio, so I'll put this up here. All right. How many of you know Visual Studio Online or TFS or whatever? Good. So most of you. How many of you know Agile? Good. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about the first decade of Agile. I did that at the Agile 2014 conference. You can look up the keynote if you want to blog about that. I'm going to talk about the second decade. I've been around Microsoft now for about 12 years. We spent the first 8 or 9 years getting Agile. And now I'm going to tell you the story about how we went in the in developer division that does Visual Studio, Visual Studio Online, TFS, Team Foundation Server, .NET, from Agile to DevOps. And we'll do a demo of how we are taking those learnings and making them available to you to do online and at home. So let me start. Can I get some sound, please? Whoever's backstage. So this is what it looked like when
we
started.
How did you forget to erase your sex tape?
Because it kept slipping my mind, and then the next thing I knew, it went up. It went up to the cloud.
And you can't get it down from the cloud?
Nobody understands the cloud. It's a mystery.
So that's us about 3 or 4 years ago. And I'm going to tell you the journey about how we went from there to where we are now and where we're trying to go. And I'm going to do this by talking about why. I'll start with why we got motivated to go there, not just because we had this thing called Azure, but why we as a, if you will, a product team wanted to go there and develop a SaaS service. And then I'll talk about how we organize ourselves in teams, how we deal with scheduling, how we deploy, what practices we apply, what we call internally live site culture, how we think about business success as part of what we're doing with telemetry and learning, and then last, how we productize. So why DevOps? Well, it's all about a usage culture. All of a sudden, you get to have this continual view of usage and this continual feedback with your customers. Just as Uli was talking about, you know, hot and cold data streams coming from sensors and machines, we have hot and cold data streams coming from customers. Okay, so we used to do these, you know, 6 monthly, roughly, customer advisory board kind of meetings and, you know, try to fly people in and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, that was one of the main forms of input. And we, you know, still do lots of web calls. But we didn't have any real way of validating what are people really using and any real statistically valid way of telling, is the stuff that we're hearing true, or what are we not hearing, or what's going on? And usage is a key thing that you get in this DevOps culture. Now, DevOps, simply put, is the realization that there aren't two life cycles. It's not that we, you know, like Ken Schwaber said when he described Scrum, go and develop to a potentially shippable increment, and that then there's separately this operations life cycle that's, you know, driven by idle or COBIT or whatever process you want, and, you know, and we deploy that and manage it however we want, but that there's one life cycle, and it's continuous, and it's fast, okay? So it started, I think, with the agile development practices, making development faster, and creating a stack of work in progress that wasn't getting deployed, and we realized from that we needed an automated release pipeline. And this led to companies like Puppet and Chef and projects like Ansible and so forth and now, in fact, Docker that are about getting stuff that's in development out to deployment through that release pipeline. And then we realized, well, you know, that stuff that's getting out there needs to be monitored. And we sort of knew about monitoring infrastructure, but we didn't really understand monitoring applications, and we now know a lot more about that and know that we need to converge how we think about performance and usage and troubleshooting in one space. And then we realized that, gee, that stuff that we're monitoring really ought to inform the next stuff that we are building so that that backlog becomes not something that we're dependent on an omniscient product owner for, but that we can instrument as experiments and learn from. So an example that really hits home to some of the stuff Scott was talking about this morning when he talked about hybrid, which applies not just to infrastructure, but to us as a company, is that we have now this service, software as a service, SaaS product, Visual Studio Online, that we deploy incremental features to every 3 weeks at the end of the scrum. They're deployed live at a scale of 2 million and some users. And we collect feedback from that. And then roughly quarterly, we roll those up into updates for our on-prem product, Team Foundation Server. And it's one code base. And so you get a preview of what's going to go on-prem by seeing what's happening in the cloud. And we share that as one code base, but we get the leading edge feedback from the cloud. Let's talk about how we manage our teams. This will be pretty familiar from Agile, slightly modified. So cross-discipline or multidisciplinary autonomous teams. Our scrum teams or feature crews are a little larger than you read about. They go up to about 12 people. They're led by two people. There's an engineering lead and a product owner or a PM in Microsoft parlance who is in the team. And and in it on a daily, hourly basis. We have transitioned or we're experimenting. We had a triad notion of development and test as separate disciplines. We're collapsing those or have collapsed those into one engineering discipline in most of our service organizations. This group stays intact for a minimum of 12 to 18 months. So we think the chemistry of the team working together is really important. If there is an imbalance at the broader level in the backlog, so Team A is got a lot of work piling up in front of it, it looks like, and we don't try to move people into it. We try to move the work off of it. So we move work to teams, not people into teams, okay? Because we think the chemistry is really pretty important here. Now, we do at the roughly 12 to 18 month interval, look at investments and organization and stuff like that, and there are opportunities to make new investments for people to move and so forth. But we try to keep people intact for at least that period. And this group pulls its backlog into the sprint. Okay. They work in team rooms. This is an example. This is in Building 18, where I work, for example. As you see, I want to make an important point. This is the full room. Behind the camera are whiteboards and a couple small so-called focus rooms, which are unschedulable little conference rooms that hold maybe 4 to 6 people. The convention is you just take it for an hour and then leave it when you're done. Not reservable, so you can go there for a private conversation. But if you want to talk to someone on your team, you swivel your chair. And if someone else overhears, that's considered a good thing because you're all working on the same stuff. This is not part of a big open room like this. Our experience is those turn into libraries where everyone tries to be really quiet. The idea is that because you're working on the same stuff, there's open conversation that happens in the room with people who ought to have open conversations with each other. Let's talk about scheduling. Now, most of you probably know Scrum and know about sprint planning and sprint reviews and sprint retrospectives and all that kind of stuff. And release planning and all that kind of stuff. Here's how we do it. We work in 3-week sprints. There's no divine reason for that. We work globally. So we have folks here in Redmond, in Raleigh, North Carolina, in Hyderabad, in India, some in Europe. So it's very globally distributed. We've tried to. It hasn't worked well. We didn't get enough done in the 2-week window to be comfortable. So we found 3 works well, and it's just a clock. We're in sprint 78. It means the same thing here as in Hyderabad. And it means the same thing to everyone in the division, and people talk across each other with sprints, and it just means the same thing everywhere. For the services, at the end of the sprint, we deploy. Now, the other end of the spectrum is this 18-month vision. So that will have with it some technology spikes. There will be a brief vision doc sort of thing, which I will write or my boss will write. There will be some conceptual storyboards, maybe some videos, some other things like that. But it's not a spec. It's sort of a North Star. Coming in, there's a sort of 6-month season. This is something Uli alluded to with Azure, and we sync with Azure. We call these by convention spring and fall. We could call them dry and wet, but spring and fall. And here we get more specific and we, you know, make plans. We'll take dependencies across groups. So we'll, say we're counting on that, containerization, or we're looking for that new service in Azure, or, whatever, in that 6-month season, and we'll let people take dependencies on the tooling we're doing. As you saw with Jay Schmelzer's demo this morning with Linux and Docker. And then in between, there's sort of a synchronization point at about 3 sprints where there's a planning chat among the team leads where they just get together and say, here's what I'm planning to do, more or less, and is there any course correction you'd like to make on that? Is there anything I should know? Are there, you know, anything you want different? Whatever, okay? And the three-week sprint is then a metronome. We don't modify the 3 weeks for holidays, you know, Christmas, New Year's, Diwali, whatever. It's just 3 weeks, and if there are holidays in the middle of it, you pull less in from the product backlog into your own iteration backlog. You manage your own capacity. At the end of, and the 3 weeks are a Monday to Friday. And then the Monday of the fourth week, we deploy. We now deploy into 6 data centers, VS Online. And I'll talk about that in a minute. The sprint plan is distributed outside the team in the form of a mail, a simple email that can be read as one page. And at the conclusion of the sprint, the retrospective, the review is an update to that email with a video that's 3 to 5 minutes in length. Not a status, not, you know, we did A, B, C, D, but a customer-facing, here's what you now can do kind of video. So, for example, here's a beginning of sprint mail with a sprint plan and a little table of the PBIs from TFS or VSO now everyone's using. And then at the end of the sprint, the same mail, the table's pushed down, unfortunately, below the fold. The video says, now here's what you can do with Git as a customer. And the table is updated to show what was accomplished and how they're, and the status of the PBIs. And this just gets circulated and then stored on our team site in SharePoint. Okay, deployment practices. Because we are a service worldwide, we're always up. We don't do downtime. We are 24/7 worldwide. All the deployment needs to be fully automated and across data centers. And that means that we need clear contracts across decoupled services. Which has meant refactoring, in our case, since we went from TFS to Visual Studio Online, it's meant a progressive refactoring into smaller and smaller services, or as we introduce new services, we start with clear contracts. We make extensive use of feature flags to allow a progressive introduction of new capabilities into the service. I'll talk about those in a minute. Those they allow us to refine over the course of many sprints what's coming in. And when we deploy, we will deploy successively across data centers so that we can effectively canary from one scale unit to the next, and the first one, of course, being the one we use, and we can see what's working, what's not working, and there's a decision point. Do we keep rolling forward, or is there something to remediate? Feature flags. So the idea in feature flags is that all the code is always deployed. In the old days, if I was working on something new, I would create a branch and I would hide my work in that branch. And then I'd come back in a few months and I'd say, now I'm ready to merge. And I would have all this merge debt accumulated. And as a result, I would go through this process and say, pick that, pick that, pick that. And then we'd go through this thing of, you know, my merge screwing up everyone else's work. The idea of feature flags is that all the code I'm working on is live or in the live instance all the time, but it's only selectively exposed. And the exposure is controllable at runtime to the level of the particular identity and the particular feature. So in other words, there is a service that determines who gets to see what at any particular time. And the addition of more users is something that can be controlled at runtime. So when we are working on something new, first the team working on it sees it, and then we expose it to our closest customers or the one people who've raised their hands and said, I want to try that out. That's the private preview you hear about. And then we progressively expand the circle, or we keep going with a small circle and refining and experimenting the new work. And that allows us to have, you know, a dark launch of something that we don't talk about that may not be fully ready. And we use that all the time. We're updating all the time, as I said, every 3 weeks. So we just keep a web page with we keep a blog, which I'm sure you've seen, where we list everything that is going into the service on each of these 3 weeks. And we then tell you when it's going into the on-prem TFS or has gone into the on-prem TFS. And that sort of becomes a key form of rolling release note sort of documentation. Now, as of about a year and change ago, about 14 months ago, we were in one data center in Chicago. Of course, everything's on Azure. We started the process of rolling into multiple data centers. And we made Chicago what we called Scale Unit 1, and took San Antonio, the South Central, and said, that'll be Scale Unit 0, where we work. And then started adding others. The most recent has been Amsterdam, which is our sixth. And when we deploy, we roll to these successively. And of course, it's automated, but automated with gates. So after Scale Unit 0, if it's working for us, we keep rolling. If it's not, we remediate and restart. We don't roll back. We only roll forward. Live site culture. Site status is always first priority. We have a very small global response team to deal with a 24/7 requirement. So like Grant Holliday, whose book some of you may have read, is the guy in Australia who handles Pacific Rim. Grant's part of this team and will handle Pacific Rim time zone sort of escalations. As the rest of the team does, he has full access to the code. He also has access to to a table of who the DRIs are, the designated responsible individuals, in each feature crew. So there's 168-hour schedule every week of who we can go to. And our internal SLA is that the DRI, if contacted by Grant, needs to be in the code within 15 minutes. So if it's 3 in the morning here, it means by 3:15 you're in the code. We look at live site incidents on a month, on a weekly basis. On a monthly basis, we do a broader service review. And live site issues become product backlog items. So we treat this as work, just like other work, feature work, that needs to be prioritized. Everyone always sees live site status. This is an ancient picture. It's probably 2.5 or 3 years old, back from when we started. Even then, we had, you know, monitors up so that everyone could see what current status was. If you walk through Building 18, for example, you'll see more monitors here. This is one happens to be in Raleigh, just so that everyone's aware all the time. And of course, if you have these, you can double click. Live site issues are captured in our previously TFS, now VSO instance. This one was primarily automated. In the information captured, you can see the outage window below, and you know, particular service was down for about an hour and brought back up. Business success is a key thing that the team is conscious of. We drive that through several things. They engage with customers. They do the service review, and we practice build, measure, learn. So we track growth rates, and everyone watches those. So we're going for you know, double-digit month-on-month growth rates, consistent with Azure. I want to talk a little bit about this November 2013 point, where you see this big jump in the slope of these curves. And I'll talk about that in a minute. We build, measure, learn, an old but simple example. When we introduced Git, we followed good web practice, had a very simple sign-up screen, and we only had 30% conversion through it. So we decided to follow lousy web practice and make a more complicated screen, ask for a lot of information. And all of a sudden, that 30 went to 50% conversion. So it was a great example of running an experiment to figure things out. We didn't know. We just tried it. We reach out to these top customers by assigning engineers on the team to our big users and just make sure they stay in touch, buddy up. What's working for you? What's not working for you? Let's talk about telemetry. This is how we aggregate monthly and look at it. We're looking at time to detect. How long does it take to find an LSI, live site incident? How long does it take to mitigate? That is, bring the service back up. What are the number of incidents by severity? What are the this graph says errors by source. It really should say incidents by root cause. And then what is the downtime by root cause? And as you can see, this doesn't have the year on here. November 2013 was pretty bad. That was when we launched VS 2013. And what we found, that was when those curves were shooting up, at that inflection point, was that we had not load tested sufficiently. And we found that we were overrunning some 64K queues that we hadn't known about. And we needed to reprioritize our backlog to do live site work. In fact, that is when we decided to go to multiple data centers and canary by data center. And as we went forward, you can see we kept getting better after doing the live site work first. So let's talk about how we've productized this. I'd like to bring up my friend and colleague, Tuck Sterling, and we'll show you how you can take advantage of much of what we've been doing in VSO and Azure, and what the DevOps capabilities now available to you are. So, Chuck.
Good morning, everybody. So my name is Charles Sterling. I am the DRI this week for load test. So if you have questions about load test, I can handle those. And I get calls from Grant Holidays on a regular basis. So that's my life right now. I actually work with the ALM Rangers as well. And we're working on these end-to-end scenarios and education for DevOps. And we've been working on this website with about 27 of these ALM Rangers. And this is the website that we've been building. They're building on it right now. And I asked them not to do any check-ins right now. So hopefully that will be the case. What I wanted to walk you through is how you guys could use our products to do what Sam just walked us through. So I'm going to go ahead and go to my Visual Studio Online, and I'm going to show you the old version of Application Insights, because that's what we started with. And you'll see that I actually have this 360 view of outside in, is my application available? And from the inside out, is it being performant? What is my code doing? And then also, how are my customers? In this case, it's the Rangers. How are they actually using it? So let's go ahead and take a look at that outside in view right off the bat. And you'll see that yesterday at noon, I had some significant problems. Now, in a traditional world, what would you do? You'd go out and you'd look at that one deployment, figure out what change set or change sets in it, and you know that that was the cause. In this case, we had 9 deployments immediately before the problem started manifesting itself. So obviously, an outside in view isn't going to work in this situation. What you want to do is actually change that filter to get a look from the inside out. And you can see right off the bat that we are using a couple different services. The blue one is actually just a temp checker, goes out and gets the temperature, and it actually has crazy wild oscillations. It's run from some community college on the East Coast, and we need to actually async that. That's a problem in our code, but it's already something that we know about. But you'll see that the team's doing a good job. They're actually doing deployments, I don't know, every couple hours, 17 all told. But we have this problem right now in that we're getting slower and slower, but we did not do a deployment. So going back to that old paradigm of looking at your last change set, it doesn't even apply here. Again, living in production, live site. This is the real world. This is what happens. But what I can do is go out to the top 10 slowest issues by count. Take a look at these different calls, and you'll see that this one is actually manifesting itself 194 times. Let's go ahead and drill down into the last one that I happen to see here. And you'll see that I get a web experience for what's actually happening in my code. And drilling down into that call stack, I can see that not only am I calling that temperature service that has these crazy oscillations, I'm actually calling the test-only instance of my recommendations engine that we're now implementing. That one is actually specifically designed to do some performance testing and capacity testing. So we're actually calling the wrong one in this case. So what we need to do is actually go back into Visual Studio. And it looks like I've got the wrong project open. My apologies. Let's go ahead and open up the right project. And here is that call. Thank God it actually opened up right off the bat. And it's just that simple. The code was actually just left as an artifact of our testing. And I go ahead and check this in. And what that's going to do, check in, is use Visual Studio Release Management to go ahead and put this not just in our test environment, but all the way out into production. So it's actually going to deploy multiple environments all the way through. And that was as simple as it was. Me doing a check-in did a continual deployment. So now that our code is in deployment, because it is, actually, this is a do-as-I-say, not-as-I-do demo as well. You should always have checks at this point where you actually have an approver push it on into prod. In this case, we're going to push it all the way through. I'm ready to make sure that performance fix, in this case removing that call, actually indeed took. So what I'm going to do is go back into the URL that's actually now timing out. It wasn't even working at this point. We're going to go back in and do a quick load test. We can't do a demo without my product in there, Sam, right? We have to demo.
Absolutely.
All right. So brand new into Visual Studio Online, we just now added the way of authoring load tests. A lot of you guys probably have not seen this. And what I'll do is go ahead and enter that URL for that broken page. Looks like I copied the wrong one. And simple load test is fine. We'll go ahead and run this for 5 minutes, 200 users. That's probably the maximum we've ever seen in this particular website anyways. But it gives us a good litmus test, a good feel, a good number that, yes, this web page is indeed fast. Now, we're way behind time. I don't think we're going to wait 5 minutes for me to run this load test. So would it, just like any good cooking show, what did I do? I cooked one ahead of time. Sitting over here, I went ahead and did a good web test. You can see what it looks like. And we actually are having some heuristics as far as, hey, if you have zero failed events, that's a good number. And as far as your performance, that's actually not looking too bad. So we're looking good, and we're in prod. So what's the next step? Next step is to get those customers that Sam was talking about. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and go back into Microsoft Azure. And again, another new feature that you guys may not have seen is this testing and production. Actually, I went through that really fast. Let me go back. And it says here, Scott's not in the room, is he still? What it says here is that my website has 4 deployment slots, but none of my traffic is going to any of those deployment slots. It's actually just going to that root node. So we're going to wait for it to refresh. And we're going to go to the home screen. And it says here, all requests to this site are being homed by the our host names getting served by the production site. So of my deployment slots, it's not being used at all. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and click here. Now, I know that my Visual Studio Release Management release pipeline pushed into build A. I'm going to go ahead and do some canary testing and have 5% of my traffic go ahead and get routed now from the site that didn't have the recommendations engine, didn't have the perf fix, into this new site, which almost brings us back full circle. The next thing that you would actually indeed do is go back into Visual Studio Online, go back into your monitoring, your production monitoring, and look at your usage data. Are my customers staying longer? Are they seeing a faster time? Do they actually enjoy the different color pages itself, or are they actually visiting the new page? I mean, it wouldn't be all that interesting as if they said that it was okay, but they actually never visited the new page we just added. That would be null data, a false positive in that case. So my name is Charles Sterling. I hope I made up some of the time, and I'm going to hand it back to Sam.
Thanks, Chuck. So this idea of deployment slots, build A, build B, and so forth, lets you do parallel testing of different versions in production, collecting usage. So you can see how the different versions compare one to the other. So you get usage comparison on your different deployment slots, and they're depending on your level of subscription, you'll have a different number of deployment slots. Standard subscription gives you 4, and so forth in the new portal. That is one of the practices that we think comprises DevOps. I talked about the schedule and team. I jumped over managing technical debt. That we learned a lot about that in the sort of first decade. It is essential that you have a very conscious attitude toward technical debt and you keep it low, and don't let it get in the way by throwing up unplanned work. If you've read the Phoenix Project, you certainly are familiar with that. That you're focusing on flow of value to the customers. The hypothesis-based backlog is why you need those deployment slots, so that you can build, measure, learn based on trying new things and collect the evidence and data with something like Application Insights or other monitoring against your sites. You're working production first so that you don't have errors or performance problems or anomalous behavior getting in the way of that real data. And you're probably using the cloud because you think that infrastructure is elastic and you provision it when you need it. Those, we think, are the new dimensions of practice that take you into a DevOps world. That's where we're trying to get excellent, and that's where we see our leading customers trying to develop their excellence as well. So you saw a bit of what we're doing in tooling. This is what we're trying to do in the practice world, and we're trying to enable a mindset of there's no place like production. Thank you very much for your attention.